Welcome to Accept Your Gifts, the 22-minute podcast for inspiring your most creative life. My name is Tracy Crow. I'm an author, writing coach, and Marine Corps veteran. I'm looking forward to co-creating today's show with you. So if you're ready, are you ready? I'm ready. So if you're ready to live a more creative, more magical life, let's get started. Has finally arrived, and with it, Women's History Month. That's right, March is Women's History Month. So I thought I'd share a little history with you today, a little personal history, along with the history of special American women who have never made it into our history books, though each one was certainly a history maker in her own right. These women, despite being silenced or dismissed or relegated to little more than a footnote in our history books for their contributions to our American military since the Revolutionary War, still recognized the power of storytelling, leaving behind gifts of written legacies that, in most cases, we're just now discovering. One of my passions these days is to share stories such as these. I confess to an agenda, and it's this, that by fully acknowledging our history and the contributions of women, we might more quickly reach gender equality. For thousands of years now, women have lived largely oppressed, and I believe it's time for the holy rebel goddess within each of us, and for all the wonderful men who support this magnificence, to awaken and serve. Not submissive serve, but, you know, the type of service that's truly necessary for co-creating a more compassionate society and world. So, here's where my story starts today. A sailor and two Marines walk into a bar. Okay, I'll pause here and let your mind wander a second. Can you picture the bar? The sailor? How about the two Marines? I can guess what you're expecting, though, that someone is about to say something a little too salty, right? Because when stories begin with a sailor and two Marines walk into a bar, we can usually expect an ending that includes a bar fight. But here's what really happened. One spring afternoon, a couple of years ago, my best friend of 37 years and a Marine veteran herself, CJ, and I walked into a brew pub near the Navy Yard in DC to meet retired Navy Lieutenant Commander Jerry Bell. We were there to have lunch. So, you see, not exactly the sailor or the two Marines you were probably expecting in this story, right? I just happened to be in D.C. to visit my husband, who was a coach for the Washington Nationals at the time. CJ just happened to be in town, too, for a conference. So when Jerry Bell, let me back up. Did I mention Jerry's also a former intel officer, a Russian linguist and scholar? So when she invited me to lunch so that she could share her idea for collaborating on a new military-themed nonfiction book, I asked CJ to tag along. Now, CJ's mission as my wingman, or rather wingwoman, was to kick me under the table if she sensed that I was even slightly thinking of saying yes to this project. I'd already produced 4 military books at that point, and a New York editor of a large publishing house had cautioned me against being labeled as just another military writer. Besides, I was in the middle of revising a novel completely non-military related, and I'd been working on it for a couple of years. I wanted to finish this novel. I had dreams of placing it with a good publisher, and I wanted to complete the internal and external requirements from shifting from just another military writer to the next great American novelist, something like that. So other than saying no to a collaboration with Jerry, which I thought would be easy since I had CJ's promise of a ninja kick under the table if I needed one, I really had no expectations for that lunch with Jerry, other than I'd be helpful and encouraging. This was going to be Jerry's first book. So I was just there to help. I listened to this retired Navy Lieutenant Commander explain the results of her year's research that had led her to believe that American women had significantly contributed to the military, even directly in combat since the Revolutionary War. She rattled off the names of women who had disguised themselves as men to serve in the Continental Army, and of the women who chose sides during the Civil War and fought as men. She told us about the cooks who took over cannons during the heat of battles, about the women who ran up and down the lines with pitchers of water to cool the guns, taking fire themselves. She told us about the women spies during the Civil War, the enormous peril in which they freely placed themselves, and about the women spies toward the end of World War II and the emergence of the Cold War. Story after story, name after name, most of whom I had never heard of, because, as Jerry explained, most women's military stories had largely been dismissed by society. The women veterans, especially the cross-dressers, had felt pressured into reintegration, even into apologies for having insulted their kind with such vulgar, manly behavior. In some cases, their stories had either been grotesquely exploited by journalists or appropriated by men. Jerry's plan was to develop the first popular history of American women's military service by using their stories told in their words, from their letters, diaries, pension depositions, oral histories, media interviews, and published and unpublished memoirs. In other words, to let their voices be heard and without the filtering of a journalist or biographer. Oh boy, I was beginning to feel the flutter of excitement. I might have heard a tiny bell go off in my mind, a sweet, pure note of resonance we occasionally hear when we're finally fully conscious, present, or that voice from someplace ancient and all-knowing within our minds that begins as a whisper and, in my case that day at lunch, ended with a five-alarm shout of, "Tracy, wake up! This project will be life-changing." Jerry, at this point, had paused, probably for air, and this was where I heard myself say something like, "This would make a great book, an important book, but you're already a year ahead of me in research. You can do this, Jerry. You don't need me." And then I held my breath. "Yes, I do need you," she said. "I don't know how to put a book together. I need you." I waited for the ninja kick from CJ, the kick that never came. Oh, how I thank God every day that Lieutenant Commander Jerry Bell thought, for some crazy reason, that she needed me. In the process of researching, compiling, and editing our book that became titled It's My Country, Two Women's Military Stories from the American Revolution to Afghanistan, Jerry and I gained a deeper awareness and appreciation for our combined 30 years of military service. At times, we even wrestled with the embarrassment that we could have served so long without knowing our own history. Until this book project, we had no idea on whose shoulders we had been standing, in whose shoes we'd been trying to fill, who had set the example for women's service and leadership, or what we might have achieved ourselves had we ignored or chipped away at externally imposed limits. Oh, we certainly didn't know how American women had come to serve in the armed forces, or what our predecessors had done and endured so that we might have opportunities they did not, and so that we might contribute fully to the defense of our Constitution. Nor had either of us known what it cost many of the women before us to step outside the conventional roles society had prescribed for them. But after a year of reading hundreds of memoirs, those personal essays, diaries, letters, pension depositions, oral histories, interviews, we realized that the excerpts we'd chosen for our book could only be properly understood in historical, literary, and historiographical context. The pact Jerry and I agreed to was that this project would not devolve into a warmongering collection of stories. While we both served honorably, neither of us would wish the war experience on anyone. The truth is, we both wish humanity would more quickly evolve towards seeking solutions other than war, but it was also equally important for us to reveal once and for all the true story of women's military contributions that for too long had been dismissed or discounted. Here's the thing. We started off with a list of women's stories we'd hoped to find. The usual suspects, you might say. But the curators and librarians we met during our year of research excitedly led us to women's stories that no one before us had ever found. Imagine. Stacks of unpublished memoirs. Stacks. Such treasures. Such gifts. But so many silenced voices, in some cases silenced for more than a century. The curators and librarians who helped us were downright giddy, as if they'd heard rumors they'd given up on, rumors that one day two middle-aged, slightly overweight women veterans would finally show up to care about giving a voice to all these silenced women. By scouring archives and collections rarely seen by more than a handful of scholars, we discovered that women veterans actually had voices, that they had published book-length memoirs and professional articles, but that most of their stories had been overlooked, ignored, dismissed as unimportant, nothing more than that footnote in history. We also learned that their story is not the story we were told during our time on active duty, nor is it the story frequently told in the news media and other contemporary accounts in which women veterans are seen in limited binary terms as either sheroes or victims of the patriarchy. Especially in early narratives, women's military stories were shaped and sometimes even changed to serve a political, social, or commercial agenda. So, Jerry and I have a different story to share with everyone now because we believe we have uncovered a unique historical and narrative arc, one that will be considered the new, accurate portrayal of the military service of women in America. For example, in April 1775, Prudence Cummings Wright, a 35-year-old mother of six from Pepperell, Massachusetts, recruited a group of 30 to 40 local women to guard a bridge over the Nashua River. The women elected Wright unit captain. She chose Sarah Shattuck as her lieutenant. One night, the women dressed in men's clothing, armed themselves, mustered at the bridge, and captured a suspected British courier mounted on horseback. They ordered him to dismount, searched him, found potentially incriminating papers. They placed him under guard overnight. In the morning, they delivered him and his documents to the nearest committee of safety. Sally St. Clair, a woman of color who served in men's attire as a gunner, became the first woman killed in action during the Battle of Savannah on December 29th, 1778. Margaret Corbin replaced her husband at his gun when he was killed at the Battle of Fort Washington on November 16, 1776. Margaret continued to fire her cannon with accuracy until British troops overran her position, captured her, and detained her as a prisoner of war. Three musket balls and grape shot had damaged her jaw and nearly detached her arm. Because of her permanent and severe disability sustained in the line of fire, Congress awarded Margaret Corbin a military disability pension in 1779, and the Army assigned her to the Invalid Regiment at West Point. In 1926, Margaret's remains were reinterred with full military honors at West Point. During the Civil War, women took advantage of still lax army physicals, which seldom checked for more than a trigger finger and enough teeth to tear open a cartridge. Kathy Williams, for example, served 4 years as a Buffalo soldier before an illness led to the discovery of her sex and a military discharge. Every American nurse today, military and civilian, stands on the shoulders of the first nurses who served so valiantly during the Civil War that nursing as a profession became acceptable for women after the war. The first nursing schools began to open in the early 1870s, and during the Spanish-American War, nurses once again provided the level of care that male orderlies hadn't been able or willing to provide. Jerry and I exchanged so many exciting discoveries of stories via Facebook messages that when she had the idea one day to print out all our messages, she'd found we'd produced more than 1,000 pages of conversations. When Congress recently lifted the ban on combat restrictions for women and the dissenters flooded the internet with comments about how women would weaken our armed forces, Jerry and I chatted back and forth about what those dissenters would make of First Lieutenant Juanita Bonham's story, a little of which I'll summarize here. On September 26, 1950, First Lieutenant Juanita Bonham awoke from a three-hour catnap at Tachikawa Air Force Base west of Tokyo. She and her teammates had just completed 245 nearly consecutive hours aloft and had evacuated more than 600 wounded American soldiers from Korea back to hospitals in Japan in a C-54 cargo plane converted into an airborne emergency room. Bonham, at 28, had served in World War II and in the Philippines and Japan during the post-war occupation. Although she had accepted a discharge when the Korean War erupted, she had volunteered for service as a flight nurse in the Air Force. Bonham drank two cups of coffee and joined the other members of her medical team, Captain Vera Brown and a male corpsman, for that pre-dawn flight. Their C-54 would carry 50 replacement troops to Kimpo and return with more wounded. The pilot suggested that Bonham and Brown get a little extra shut-eye, but the women chatted through takeoff into a stormy sky. The plane turned east over the Sea of Japan. Half a mile from shore, the engine stalled. The C-54 plummeted to the ocean. The impact broke the plane into three parts and filled with water. Bonham had been knocked out. She regained consciousness completely submerged in total darkness while still inside the plane's fuselage. She fought her way to the surface and kicked clear of the sinking aircraft. Around her, men fought wind and waves. Those who had not survived the impact or who had drowned floated around them. Bonham grabbed onto a floating barracks bag as it drifted by. In the darkness, a man's voice called out, "There's a life raft here. How do you inflate it?" Bonham called back, "Yank it out of the case and it will inflate itself." Moments later, she saw the raft and swam to it. She grabbed the trailing rope with one hand and the nearest soldier with the other, guiding him to the rope. Then she reached for another man, saw a second raft, grabbed another soldier. 17 men climbed into the raft. Bonham Bonham remained in the cold water until she was sure that every survivor she could see had entered one of the two rafts before allowing the men to pull her aboard. The pilot and co-pilot were dead. Captain Brown, the senior flight nurse, missing. Knowing that she was responsible for the safety of these survivors, Bonham ignored a broken left wrist in pain that suggested other serious injuries. She took charge and directed the soldiers to lash the two rafts together. Some were panicking and wanted to try to swim ashore. She ordered them to remain in the rafts until help arrived, reminding them of the danger from sharks and the likelihood of being swept out to sea by the storm. Controllers at Tachikawa did not realize that the C-54 had gone down. Several other aircraft flew overhead, but did not see the two rafts because of poor visibility. Japanese fishing vessels finally sighted the rafts after daybreak. Bonham managed to remain conscious while the men attached the rafts to a fishing boat, which towed them safely to shore. Juanita Bonham spent 9 months in the hospital recovering from a broken right shoulder, broken left wrist, broken cheekbone, and a skull fracture that required 3 surgeries. She was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, the Air Force's 2nd highest decoration for valor. I mean, what do you have to do to get the first? Jerry and I also found the long-forgotten stories of the first female aviators who were willing to fly test planes that no man would fly, at least not until he saw that a woman could fly it. We uncovered stories that angered us so much, we joked we would need serious therapy after this book. We sometimes had to apologize for unfairly snapping at our husbands after a day of reading stories that just made our skin crawl, such as the documented story of a military psychologist who insisted women aviators submit to his psych evaluations while standing before him, totally nude. Whatever personal problems plagued us during that year of research, and, you know, they were plenty for both of us, we drew strength from the women whose stories were profoundly touching our lives and uplifting us. In the end, we could include only a fraction of the good stories we found. Frustrating gaps remain. The stories of many firsts and trailblazers were often told only by others, often men. We ran into dead ends in our research. For example, the family of African-American Civil War spy Mary Bowser discarded her diary in the 1950s, totally unaware of its significance. Women who served in the Korean War era, like their male counterparts, veterans of the forgotten war, reintegrated into civilian society, and most chose not to talk about their experiences. We were unable to do justice to the record of women veterans of color, some of whom left excellent and candid memoirs, or to the complex intersection of race and sex that shaped their stories. And too few women Coast Guard veterans have committed their stories to paper. So, some, I suppose, could ask, so what? So what if we've gone this long and never fully grasped our military history as American women? So what? We're doing okay now, right? Are we? Are we okay with the current military culture? With statistics that reveal 1 in 4 military women are the victim of military sexual trauma? What does this say about us as a country, for that matter? What sort of culture do you suppose we might co-create if we started with our military men, enlisted and commissioned, exposing them to the stories of women who wanted so badly to serve their country they cross-dressed as men during the earliest wars, or to the stories of the women test pilots, to the stories of women nurses held as POWs in the Philippines, to the stories of women gunners during World War II who trained sailors how to shoot down Japanese planes because, in the words of one female instructor to a smart-mouthed sailor in her class one day, We all know how close you boys came to losing Guadalcanal. And what sort of military culture might we develop if our young enlisted women and officers were to fully understand and embrace their own military history, their own American history? For a little more than 2,000 years, humanity has been living under a blanket of amnesia as it relates to the power of women. The waking up has been slow and painful. It's time. Wake up. It's time to wake up, holy rebel goddesses. It's time. Wake up. I hope you enjoyed today's co-creative listening experience. Please remember to leave a comment about the single greatest takeaway for you today. You know, that one thing you will remember from this day forward. Was it something funny or provocative? Was it just what you needed to hear? Please share so we can all benefit. And remember to return Tuesdays and Thursdays to accept your gifts, the 22-minute podcast for inspiring your most creative life.